And welcome to the Tacona Morning Drive podcast. This episode, I am joined by my friend Terry Putman, aka Illustrator Maker. He is an automotive artist that creates amazing pieces of artwork, especially of other people's cars, for them predominantly. He also created the Lego Countach artwork for me for the March 2022 t-shirt. And has had a very interesting and varied career leading him to this point. So we sat down to chat cars, chat artwork, and chat some mental health, which is always a really nice one to include in these conversations. So, on with the podcast. I've hit record now. But that doesn't really mean anything in particular. We'll just chit-chat like we normally would.
Yep.
There will be a little bit of potential background noise as we have a puppy in the room, but that's okay. That's part of the atmosphere, I think. Don't expect anything in terms of... I've not got like a notepad with questions or anything like that. It's just an exercise in conversation to promote conversation and to kind of demonstrate how easy it is just to chat to people.
Yeah.
So, like, whether it's someone that I've known really a long time or whether it's, say, someone that's within the automotive world that I've never met before, it's just to demonstrate that it's easy just to talk to people if you put the effort in a bit. And it's surprising what conversations come out of it with no expectation, which is another, like, a nice part to it. So, today I'm joined by Terry Putman. I got that right.
You did.
I'm terrible with surnames. Also known as, is it Illustrator Maker or
yes.
Illustration Maker?
Illustrator Maker.
Illustrator Maker.
Yeah.
I've just been taking photos of your Escargo because I've parked around there. you designed the Lamborghini Countach Lego T-shirt of the month. We did that together.
Yeah.
You do some amazing artwork. I'm sat next to a gigantic 356 piece that you've done. Much higher standard than any of the art stuff that I do, because you actually draw it and make it look like a thing. I just do outlines and block colour, because that's all I need to do a t-shirt.
Exactly. And but your newest t-shirt, by the way, with the lovely rainbow colours on the Porsche.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Like, my favourite piece you've done by a mile.
Really?
I know that sounds like cheesy now as we're sitting recording this stuff going, oh, I think you're brilliant. But honestly, it's my favourite thing you've done, definitely.
Oh, thank you. I did the typical thing of, when I was in school, I didn't really have to study too much. And therefore, as an adult, I have never had to put any real pressure on myself to meet deadlines.
Yeah.
And it's always one of those, like, oh, crap, I need to get this done. So I locked myself in the room, in our little office room for 13 hours until there was a piece of artwork at the end of it.
Well, it's good, honestly. Yeah, it looks really good. It's honestly my favourite
piece. The problem
is,
when you say that, that just reinforces my bad behaviour. Like, oh, I did so, a really good one, yeah, so I'll therefore I'll do that next month. And every time I need to get something done, I'll wait till the
just
very
wait
last,
till
minute.
Last minute.
And then that forces the creativity out.
Yeah, see, that seems familiar to me as well. I think very, very similar of the whole at school, was lucky enough to be intelligent enough to not need to really try.
Yeah.
But not intelligent enough to know that actually trying would be beneficial long term.
Yeah.
And just going, I'm going to scrape through by not really trying, getting to where I need to get to.
Never
and
really
then just
have
going,
to apply yourself.
Never have to apply yourself. And then going, adult world, going, ah, doesn't quite work in the real world all the time like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, and my other half is the exact opposite in that she's always about 3 months early for deadlines. And she's always like, right, I've got something that I need to do. I'll get it done now. And then I won't have this anxiety-inducing pressure at the end of it.
Again, that seems, my other half is very much the same. It's like, plan it months ahead. It's already done. I don't even have to worry about it. Whereas I'm very much the night before.
Which is how we've ended up 2 days before Goodwood going, I mean, we should get a Goodwood ticket.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We might be able to go and network there. Rather
yeah,
than just
it might
go,
be beneficial to be there.
Yeah, because normally, when I've done Goodwood in the past, it's been my birthday present is a Goodwood ticket. I'll go with my father-in-law and we'll go and just look at cars and like mooch around. And the last one that I did was pre-COVID, when my first ever Tacona t-shirt got printed the day before.
Wow, okay.
So I took it and very naively went, I'm going to wear this t-shirt and everybody's going to see it. And then everyone's going to go, oh, that's really cool, I'll buy one. No, that didn't happen at all. And I think there's only about three of those t-shirts that exist.
Really?
Because it was very, very early into it all. But that was the last Goodwood I went to. Obviously, we had lockdown. And then two lock, two down. And then last year, I think, was when it kind of opened back up again.
Yeah, I think last year was the first one, but it wasn't. It was kind of smaller than previous years, I think.
When they had that you can have up to X amount of people if you're a registered trial venue.
And less capacity than normal kind of.
Yeah, and everybody had to have tested 2 days prior, and they had to have the app and this, that, and the other. So this is the first year it's kind of back to how it's supposed to be, and it's the first year where I'm going and like bumping elbows with people that I'll know from the industry.
Yeah,
which is a weird one, having gone from the last one I was there was completely like, God, what? Oh my God, look at all these cars. To this year, going and going, right, I know so-and-so will be there. I know they'll be there. Yeah. I know. And these are all people that previously go, oh my God, that's so-and-so.
Yeah, that you see from afar going, oh, wow, look at that. Yeah,
I'll use Henry as a reference point just because he's probably one of my most well-known connections, him and Alex Goy.
Yeah.
I know Henry's going to be there, and I'll hopefully bump into him. And I think Alex will most likely be there.
I'd be amazed if he's not. Yeah,
he's probably somewhere around the Morgan stand shouting about how good three-wheel cars are, which is entirely true. But it's one of those where previously I go, oh, my God, it's Alex Goy. Oh, my God, there's Henry Catchpole. And now we're like, morning, how's it going? Like,
yeah.
And it's such a weird thing to now be on the other side of that, which I'm guessing you're starting to get more of now as well.
A little bit, yeah. It's a bit weird because... So I've never been to Goodwood.
Oh, that would be fun.
Which is nuts.
Down.
Yeah. So being a car person, and obviously Goodwood is like a rite of passage. That's one of those things that you need to go to. And it's always been one of those things I've managed to catch on TV, on ITV4 or whatever it is, and see the stuff down there, but never actually managed to get to. And I'd never even been to the site until like a month or so ago when I did Retro Weekenders down there.
Yeah.
When you were there as well. And that
Which
was the first time I'd ever been there.
Where the Festival of Speed is?
No, the festival is kind of over the road, isn't it? Because it's on the hill climb bit rather than on the actual track.
On the track, yeah.
So, it's one of those things that I've always wanted to do and never done. And I think living close to Silverstone, I kind of got spoiled childhood-wise and growing up that it's half an hour drive to Silverstone, and it always is.
Yeah.
And so I took it for granted. So I'd be at Silverstone half a dozen times a year at least, and would visit other sort of circuits and stuff, but then in terms of other car things, never really went much further afield because I had plenty on my doorstep.
Well, we're in kind of
almost
Formula
car
One
country,
aren't we?
Exactly,
like past the AMG production.
On the way here,
Oh my God, there's some amazing roads to get here.
Yeah,
it's really nice, lovely roads
around here. Yeah, exactly. I think, I don't know, it's weird chatting to someone who's not local and now living local as well. It's kind of, I kind of see things in a slightly different perspective. It's like I take these things for granted that, Mercedes at AMG are 20 minutes away and, then over in Brackley, the other, and ProDrive over in, Banbury and stuff like that. And all of that kind of thing is not a million miles away.
Well, we're the other side of Northampton to you, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, we're the west side, but we're both north. But, it's 40 minutes to Bicester for us. It's 20 minutes to Silverstone.
Exactly,
It's literally, like, that's the reason we moved here, is that we're so central to everything that we need.
Yeah.
It's only an hour to Caffeine and Machine.
Yep.
It's only 2.5 hours to Goodwood.
Yeah.
Which is surprisingly.
Yeah.
Like, when I lived, the first time I went to Goodwood, I got free tickets. Because my friend from school worked for, it's one of the big Renault dealers, like the franchises.
Right.
And they did this, it's like this open day at Wollaton Hall, which is Batman's house.
Yep.
From the Christopher Nolan series. And we went down and they had this little competition where it was basically like a data gathering thing. But the prize was two tickets to Goodwood.
Right. Okay.
On the Thursday, which is the quieter, like press day.
Press day sort of thing,
If you're in the cold, the best day to go. And I registered and that obviously gave my name and it says, what car do you drive? And it's like, I've got a GTA 6. So I got a phone call and it was like, is this Lewis Warren? I was like, yeah. He's like, you've got a GTA 6. I was like, yeah. He's like, is it a black GTA 6? I was like, oh, that wasn't one of the questions on the form. I was like, it is. How do you know? He's like, oh, we went to school together. He was like one of my best mates in school.
Oh,
and we
really?
Just kind of know as you grow up and you kind of drift apart a bit. And we moved away from the area and stuff. So he's like one of my closest friends in the school, but as we'd grown up, I'd moved away and he'd kind of, life gets in the way of these things.
Yeah.
So I'd not seen him for nine years.
Right.
And he was like, oh yeah, I know who you are. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. He went, oh, you've won the tickets, by the way. I was like, oh, I would kind of expect so after this point. So my first experience of Goodwood was a 4-hour drive at 4 o'clock in the morning to get there for 8,
crammed as much in as we could and still only saw half.
Really?
With one of my best mates, and then back up again in the evening.
Yeah.
And it was mad. You just kind of get there and you're like, what is going on? It's like, you know when you see like the Geneva Motor Show and there's that huge hall full of all the different car manufacturers? It's like you took that, times it by about three, and then added all the cars that you've ever wanted to see into the mix.
In one place, sort of thing.
And it's all kind of in one place. And then there's every racing car you've ever wished to have seen going up that hill. And all the mad other stuff that's now part of it, like the drift arena and stuff like that. So it's
huge, isn't it?
Like car mecca.
Yeah.
The thing with it is, if you do 2 years on the trot, you'll see everything twice.
Right.
So if you're only going there to see the stuff that's there,
yeah,
kind of every other year is the better way to do it.
Right, okay.
Whereas if you go in there to mingle and connect,
you
just go, that's £45 for a ticket.
Yeah, something like that,
Which is a lot for a ticket, but you get a lot for your money.
Yeah.
And if you're doing it from a business perspective,
it's an easy one
business
to justify.
Expense for networking and marketing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I personally would say, get a ticket, jump in with me, and we'll go down together.
Yeah, and that's the thing, I think, just
this will go out after this has all happened, by the way. So, from the listener's perspective, me and Terry had a great time at Goodwood.
It was amazing, yeah. Yeah, I think it's just one of those things, it's like, oh, I must do that. And a bit like, there's certain other things that you sort of, in the car industry or car world, that I think you'd sort of need to do in like certain motor museums, like at Gaydon or at like Bewley and things like that. And I think there are things that you're like, oh yeah, I know I must do that at some point, and you kind of never get around to doing it.
Yeah. I've never been to Gaydon. That's on my list of ones to go to.
Yeah, I think my only first visit, because again, it's not far from here at all. It was probably only 2 or 3 years ago, my first ever visit, even though I grew up around here and things like that, yeah.
It's mad, isn't it? You kind of don't realise what's on your doorstep half the time.
No, exactly. And you kind of, I don't know, if you're looking for things to do, you kind of look further afield than local. You're like, well, let's make a day
make
of it,
it
and,
yeah,
and
make it road a trip. Because you know, the Great British Journey, I think it's called, it's all like... so like a motor museum, but it's full of like Austin Princesses and Anglia.
Oh, isn't that up Nottingham direction?
It's in Ambergate, which is technically in Derbyshire.
Right.
Which
sorry, all Derbyshire people to say it's near Nottingham. That's horrible. Yeah, the rivalry aside.
Derbyshire is like the second or third biggest county in the country,
huge,
which is
isn't
wild
it,
that everyone's like, it's near Nottingham. It's like, it's not though.
Yeah.
It's near Matlock is the one that everyone will go.
Okay.
To go to is Matlock. Every road sign in Derby can lead you to Matlock. So if you know where Matlock is in relation to where you need to be, every road sign will take you to Matlock.
Right, okay.
The difficulty is if you start, say, point A is like south, point B is kind of northeast, and Matlock is west, you'll go into Matlock to come back out again. So that's of no help. But if you are lost in Derby or Derbyshire, and you need to find your way out, all road signs take you to Matlock in the area, because it is the tourist spot, so they all lead you there. But it's near there, but it's actually 10 minutes from my dad's house.
Oh, really?
It's literally around the corner from where I grew up.
Oh, okay.
And I still haven't been.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Okay,
a year or so now?
Yeah, it was last year, wasn't it? I think, because I seem to remember getting things through, sort of emails through about, like, they were sort of doing advertising it as, like, come and drive what your dad drove kind of scenario kind of thing. So, yeah, stuff from the 60s and 70s, lots of that kind of stuff. You know,
the thing is, if I turn up in my Renault 5, I'm kind of like, I'm already there.
Yeah, I'm fitting in, yeah.
My dad had a 205 GTI, so I don't know if they've got one of those.
That's pretty cool, as a car to have had.
I think I cried when he sold that. I was only like 5. But that's how ingrained cars are.
Yeah.
From my like growing up, was that I cried when he got rid of that 205 GTI. And then he bought a Celica, and it was a D-Reg Celica, so it was still the wedge
shape. Oh, sort of 80s wedge, yeah.
Yeah, with the pop-up lights.
Yeah.
So I was immediately, like, happy. And then it just broke down all the time.
Well, anything with pop-up lights is good,
yeah.
Especially from a child point of view.
Yeah.
Pop-up headlights are brilliant.
The guy that bought my dad's 205 came in an XJ.
Really?
And I was like, can't you just swap him for that? And I was like, we can't swap the Peugeot for a Jaguar. Yeah. And now, arguably, they're the other way around.
As I say, the 205 is probably far more desirable than the XJ.
I should probably ask the one question that I do ask everyone, as we're now 15 minutes in almost.
Chatting rubbish, yeah.
Who are you and what do you do?
So, I am Terry Putman, or Illustrator Maker, and I draw cars and other stuff.
I don't think I've seen any of your other stuff other than your cars.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, really, because I think I've been doing this under Illustrator Maker for about a year now, roughly. I think it was kind of May last year that I started. And it kind of was never started as a sort of let's do car drawing as a business type of thing at all. Really wasn't intended like that. It kind of started with I drew the Alpha was the first drawing sort of that I did, the blue and red Alpha, which coincidentally is Rev's logo. So my naivety and short-term knowledge of the car world, hadn't got a clue who Rev's was.
Yeah.
No idea that existed, never seen this red and blue Alpha before. It was my dad's birthday coming up. I was doing some drawing practice because I just started doing my master's in illustration. So I was literally just practicing drawing. I was like, oh, I'll do dad a drawing for his birthday.
Yeah.
He's obsessed with Alf, as most men of his age are. And anybody in the car industry understands the sort of the Alpha connection. And I, rather than drawing just a plain red one, I found this lovely Julia that was blue and red, and I was like, wow, what an awesome colour combination.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I'll draw that. Drew that, tweeted about it, and it was the week that Chris Harris and Top Gear had driven the Alphaholics one.
Yeah.
So I tagged Chris Harris, says, this looks similar to your Alphaholics thing. That was it. He replied and retweeted it saying, this looks awesome. Then Illustrator Maker was born, literally like that. I then asked, had people asking me to send them copies of the drawing. I had a guy in Singapore, one guy in Sweden, like within like a few hours of this tweet going out, suddenly wanting copies of my drawing. And I was like, whoa, this is a birthday present for my dad. This is not a business thing or anything. And I was like, okay, let me find out how much it costs to print and post it to you, then you can have a copy of it. And yeah, it kind of just went from there.
Amazing.
So yeah, it was kind of like, oh, I'll do some more cars then. If people seem to want them, I'll carry on drawing cars. Because it was always a thing that, you know, as I said, started my illustration masters, wanted to go from being teaching full-time to eventually be illustrating full-time.
Yeah, the biggest fly has just come in this room.
It's actually the size.
It might take the puppy with it.
I think it could easily carry him, especially as he's sleeping for a change. And it was, yeah, so it was, the illustration thing was going to be, I want to illustrate and eventually illustrate books. That was what I wanted to do. Was
right,
be children's book illustration. And the cars were just a thing that I was doing on, alongside my studies for just practice of drawing. Because I know cars inside out, that's my bread and butter. I could draw them with my eyes closed kind of thing because I've always been into cars. I studied car design at Coventry University back in the day. And so cars are second nature. So that was just basically drawing practice. And then that kind of went from there, really, yeah. And people started wanting them, and then I was like, oh, I'm kind of enjoying drawing these cars, so maybe I should lean into it a bit more. And as I'm enjoying doing it, so rather than just doing it as a bit of drawing practice, it then became my sort of escapism, a way of dealing with mental health issues, not necessarily issues, but just a way to sort of just zone out. And because I found it sort of second nature to do the car stuff, I could literally just stick my headphones in and zone out for a few hours, and the world had just passed me by and I wouldn't have a clue what was going on outside sort of thing. So it was almost meditative at certain points.
It's kind of like mindfulness, isn't it?
Exactly.
They do those colouring books and things like that.
Yeah.
It's
you're so focused on that one task, you're just completely unaware of what else is going on around you.
Yeah. Which is a real blessing and a real curse.
Yes.
Because you are therefore in your own little world, non-contactable to the world for
exactly
the best part of 12 hours, whatever it is.
And that's it. And then when you've got the real world going on outside, you know, partners, children, housework needs doing, all the rest of it, it's you kind of, you know, have to snap back out of it and get back into the real world. So, but yeah, that's kind of how the Illustrator Maker thing came around, which is why the name has nothing to do with cars.
Yeah, yeah.
At all.
It has a lot to do with what you do, so it works.
Yeah. And the maker, everyone's like, what's the making things? Like, well, the name came up before I started drawing cars, and it was just somewhere for me to do my illustration work. But so previous to that, so my teaching stuff was, I was a design technology teacher.
Right.
So I taught woodwork, metalwork, graphics, and a bit of art. So I like getting my hands dirty and making things as well. So it was always that the intention to be any sort of business or self-employment would involve some sort of hands-on crafting as well as the sort of drawing aspect of it. So that's where the maker thing came in. Although that has kind of taken the back seat.
Have you got
for a while.
The tools and things to pick something like that back up and incorporate it?
Yeah.
Because I know growing up, my dad had a lathe and a milling machine and a like a plane and all that. But he was doing, like him and my granddad used to make four-poster beds.
Wow, okay.
Like they were doing that kind of stuff rather than the more intricate kind of bits. But it would be very easy for you to transfer some of this in a, not in the same vein, but in a similar way to how Johnny Ambrose does his car stuff.
Exactly, yeah, into his is all like skeletal 3D kind of stuff.
Printed and stuff like that, but you could very much do a sculpture-based
and that's it. I think, the next sort of thing, I think that as the car thing seems to be going all right, that I want to push more into the sort of mixed media. So rather than it just being digital, then having certain bits printed onto timber. And I've been playing around with bits of timber that I've had stuff printed onto before.
Yeah.
And then showed layering
that McLaren
them up. That's it. Yeah.
Board, didn't you?
So I think that's, a logical next step for me is to incorporate more of that.
Could laser cut some stuff quite easily as well.
And that's it. So I used to run my own laser cutting business as well a few years ago. Yeah. So a laser cutting a bit, to me, is a bit like drawing. It's sort of second nature. Sort of, and especially having taught it through schools, it's easy enough to do. So, unfortunately, I did sell my laser cutter a few years ago, but it's easy enough to get hold of a small, cheaper one again to sort of play with. But that's definitely something that would be...
One of the difficulties I've heard about laser cutting is the materials, depending on which one you have, you can only cut into either metal or wood. Like, Grace's uncle has a laser cutter, and I'm like, oh, could you engrave and stuff? He's like, no, it cut straight through wood.
Yeah.
It has to be metal, otherwise it would just go through it. And he's like, it'll go through your hand. I was like, okay, I won't put my hand near it.
Yeah, and that's it. So there's basically two types of laser. Yeah, one for metalwork and one for woodwork.
Mm.
They use a complete... They, as much as they're both called a laser, they work in very, very different ways, the frequency they work at. So, it's woodwork, laser work that I used to do. I don't know, it's quite nice to sort of play with that because you've got so much control over the laser itself that you can be extremely detailed or you can be really sort of like ham-fisted with it and cut through great big chunks of wood if you need to, or you can do really tiny, delicate little things, less than a millimetre thick, sort of like engraving and stuff.
That's so brilliant, isn't it?
It's such a clever bit of kit.
Grown throughout the years.
Yeah, and it's, it's the cost has come down, so it's something that you can buy for. You can buy one that's sort of A3 size for less than £1,000, easily sort of things, a few hundred quid.
Yeah.
Similar sort of price to a decent 3D printer. Which is mad. Yeah.
Really mad.
Yeah.
But not to detract and sidetrack us off from the car, the stuff that you do, like, you've just now gone into the technicalities of laser cutters. That's how, in all fairness, that's how conversations go. And I like that these conversations are in that kind of unstructured format so that these things can happen. Like, when Mike and I were doing one every week, when I lived within 3 minutes walking distance from him.
Yeah.
That's basically what we would do. We'd go, right, we've got a rough couple of points that are car related.
Yeah.
But this is going to be an hour and a half of two blokes just chatting. And it would go off onto all sorts of different tangents. And I think we had about 8 people listen to them. It's like, and one of them was a friend of ours. Like, for Jared and the other 7 of you, thank you for putting up with this shit for as long as you have. Whereas these morning drive ones are a little bit more focused. And because it's not me and my best mate that we can just talk about anything because there isn't that like getting to know you as such part of it, which anyone listening to this will realise that this is a little bit more like that because I do know you rather than it's time to learn who you are as a person.
Yeah.
Like the one that I did yesterday was an hour and a half of me going, that was cool. This is cool. How do you do that? God, that's amazing. Because it was someone that does things that I can only dream of doing. And said person has driven the Porsche GT1, the CLK GTR, and the McLaren F1 GTR the same day.
Whoa, what a day.
Yeah, and I was asking about it. He was like, it was a very stressful day. those opportunities don't come about twice.
No.
And we got, I think they were doing Millbrook's Hill Circuit, their Alpine Circuit, which looks like the Welsh countryside.
Yeah,
I was like, I didn't realise that wasn't a road. He's like, yeah, that's a Millbrook.
Yeah.
He's like, we had 3 laps in each car to get all of the footage that we needed
that's
to do.
That's not a lot at all, is it?
No. So it was, like, the only time that I wasn't focused on work was after we'd done all that and they were doing tracking shots with a photographer.
Yeah.
And he's like, I got to just drive these cars, just to drive them. Like, yes, there was a camera in that, but that was... They were focusing on the car, not me, so I could just enjoy being in it. And he was like, yeah, that one's a memory that will stick. I was like, I'm so jealous.
Yeah, that's just nuts.
Like just driving a GT1 with a CLK GTR there and an F1 GTR there. It's just insane.
Yeah.
So that was a very much more like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
What's that? Oh my God, I'm so jealous of you all the time. Rather than that, I know who you are. We often spend time around each other. And this is more of a nice chance to catch up and to chat and to hopefully share a bit more about what you do and where it's come from and what you're planning on doing. And that leads me into my next question. How did you end up with an S-Cargo?
Well, the simple answer is because I wanted one. And it was a case of my Focus ST had just split its block.
Oof. That's good going.
You say that, but actually they're quite renowned for it.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the ST engine is not particularly strong and not particularly well built. So one of the first mods that people do to it is called a block mod, where they basically put some extra strengthening into the block. So if you take the head off, and then you can strengthen it that way. I had no reason to take the head off of mine, so I hadn't done it, but then found out the hard way.
That it broke.
And it just wasn't viable to then pump more money into a car that's 20 years old already, kind of thing. It'd done 120,000 miles.
That's good going, to be fair.
Exactly, yeah. And it was one of those cars, it did everything I needed it to do. It's plenty big enough for me and the kids, and it put a smile on the face every time I put my foot down, kind of thing. And it, the 5-pot just sounded brilliant. I think it's one of those engines that just, yeah, it gets into you. It was great. But so from that, it was kind of like, well, I need still some daily transport, but I'd been sort of on the back of my mind thinking about getting some sort of van or commercial vehicle for taking to the shows and lugging all my kit around, rather than filling the Focus and seats down and roof boxes and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Which had just, as my sort of, the more shows I've done, the more stuff I seem to
accumulate. I'm getting close to needing something bigger than the 86.
Yeah.
Which is annoying, because that car ticks all the boxes so well.
Yeah.
So it's one of those where you either have to be more efficient with what you take,
yeah,
or you have to get something
bigger or different. Yeah.
Funnily enough, the Renault has got more internal space.
So really?
If it is needed, I can fill that with the motor, which I'm going to have to do next month, actually I need to sort out. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
And it's just one of those things that it then became, okay, so I need something, let's get a commercial vehicle. I didn't have much money to throw at it, and it was kind of like, right, let's look what I can get. So I had like a budget of like $3,000, and it was kind of like, okay, for $3,000, I could get a Transit that's done moon mileage, you know, 250k or something like it, you know, which, you know, parts are readily available, but still it's done that sort of mileage, so it's going to need some looking after or whatever.
Yeah.
Or I look a bit further afield and sort of see what else is about. And it's a weird thing. The S-Cargo, I first saw one in the flesh probably about 15 or 16 years ago, sort of mid-2000s, I reckon, in Cardiff. There was a guy who was running a hotel in Cardiff, and he had one, and he used it as his like laundry vehicle to take it to and from laundry. And I happened to get chatting to him. And it's like, what on earth is that? And he's like, oh, this is an S-Cargo. And I was like, oh, that little thing. Yeah, now you said it. I do remember those little things that were drawn in Japan in the early 90s. Like, never seen one before.
And one of the, it's either Magneto or Road Rat, in a relatively recent issue, goes through the history of them all.
Oh, really?
And the Figaro and the
B1 and the POW. Yeah.
All of it goes through how they came about.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's a great story. And if you're into that sort of thing, quirky Japanese K-car kind of thing, then yeah. And me, I've always had, I don't know, I've always been a bit sort of slightly left-field in my choices of vehicles and things like that, and I think it just sort of suits me. It's like, well, do I get an old VW Caddy or an old Transit van and put a badge on the side of it, or do I get something quirky?
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, well, actually, I've always quite liked the S-Cargo. This one came up, it needed some work doing to it, but I thought for $3,000, it's
different, and it gets noticed, and it gets
exactly recognized. It ticks a lot more boxes than a Transit would for the same sort of money.
Yeah, yeah, and you'll have the same effect that I get in the Renault, like on the motorway, where people will look at it and
they
won't look at it because it's sign written, they'll look at it because of what it is, and
exactly,
they'll see what the stickers are.
Yeah, the amount of, like, even, you know, parked just outside my house here, I'm near a school. The amount of times, if I'm out there any time that there's any children around, kids want to come and see it, they want to come and sit in it, ask me what it is, and that sort of thing. And it's great. I'm, you know, more than happy for people to come and do that. you know, more people enthusiastic about weird, quirky Japanese cars, then the better. So
it's one of the joys of the car world, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It can ignite those little sparks in people. Like, because that Escargo will undoubtedly be, in 20 years, the why are you into cars car.
Exactly,
oh, that guy
yeah.
near me had one.
Had one of them, yeah.
And I loved it, and now I love cars, yeah. and I love quirky cars and things like that.
Yeah.
It's one of those kind of things. Like, I imagine my little Renault's probably done that for a couple of kids. Or
exactly, yeah.
I was going into the Duke of London a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
Satellites, little kid with his mum pointing at the... I was in the 86.
Yeah.
And obviously it's got a moustache on the front, and it's all stickered
Stick it up, yeah.
And this little kid's pointing at it. So I gave it a little bit of a rev, and I saw his face light up. So when the lights changed, I was like, what? And his mum looked at me like, what a knobhead. But this little boy was so
happy.
Excited.
Yeah, big grin on his face. Yeah.
And I was like, you kind of have to do these things because you are that person for someone else. Now.
Exactly,
if
yeah.
If you had an experience when you were a kid, seeing a cool car or being near something exciting,
yeah.
If that person was nice and engaged with your excitement,
yep.
it creates these positive experiences that
exactly.
become part of who you are. If I had been a knobhead about it, it's not like I went, don't touch my car. It's not that kind of thing. But it's one of those, if you can, you should, because it hurts nobody.
Exactly, yeah. And it's something, I don't know, it's weird. Some people get it and some people don't. It's like... my dad was like, oh, why are you chatting to that guy over there? So, well, he came and asked me about the car. I was like, really? He's like, yeah, I was just getting something out of the boot and he came and asked me about this cargo. So I was standing there for half an hour chatting to him.
Yeah.
Just because he was interested in what it was. And everyone's got some sort of car story to go with it. Mm. Like, whether they're into cars or not, everyone's got a connection because of, you know, it's transport and it's your childhood and it's nostalgia.
Yeah, yeah.
And this guy, yeah, he's, you know, elderly guy, he must be mid-80s, I'd say he is. So, oh, I've never seen that before. It's like, oh, yeah. Back in the day, I used to run a Mark II Escort.
Nice.
That was my thing. And it was like I kept it till it was probably 30 years old and then gave it to my son and stuff like that. And it's like, well, that chat happened because I was getting something out of the boot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And
they
just happened to see
connections, don't they?
It's mad. And since I've seen him down the street and said hello to each other and stuff, you know, I wouldn't have had that opportunity or that connection with people without that, you know, the stupid little snail van that sits out on the road.
But that's the kind of the reason that Tacoma exists in the car world, is to use those connections. Like, it's acknowledging that's what it does.
Yeah.
And time again, that's where friendships have started. It's where positive memories have come from. It's how people get away from the world for an hour is to go for a drive. Like, there's so many good things that people that don't get involved in the car world or don't care about cars don't understand, or at least don't know about.
Yes, yeah.
And I think it's really important that conversations happen that talk about that side of the car world, because we are at a point where it's going to become a dying market.
Very much so, yeah.
The enthusiast cars will die off. Brands won't be investing in that world. And cars seem to be leaning towards just being a form of transport again.
Yeah.
Rather than having any sort of character. Although there are some people making characterful cars for the future, but not within a price range that I'm going to be in anytime soon.
No, and I think that's the danger, isn't it? Certainly the current sort of market, obviously, new car prices are crazy anyway for the average person to be able to afford a new car, whether it's electric or not.
Well, the Honda City E is a 35 grand car.
Which is nuts, because I love the look of it.
Yeah.
I absolutely think it's great. And I think the, you know, youth of today, people who want to be interested in that kind of size car.
Yeah.
There's no way they're ever going to have 35k to spend on a brand new car.
No, it's like that Citroen Ami thing.
Yeah.
That's just come out. They're like, oh, it's 20 quid a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you put $3,000 down and then pay $6,000 at the end.
The end, yeah. It's like, wait a minute. I really like the Ami. I think it's cool. It's very niche. And I think it would solve a lot of problems in terms of entry level to electric motoring if they'd magically made a sort of, you know, a four seat version of it. If it was big enough to sort of get four people in it, just stretched it a bit, but the same sort of premise, I think, is really cool. So I saw that in the flesh last summer. I think it was at Carfest or somewhere like that, and I had my girls with me.
British Motor Show.
Was there one at the motor show?
Yeah, like tucked in the middle.
Oh, maybe there was. Yeah, because that was my first show, was the British Motor Show last year. It was the first event I did. Was
oh,
the
was
British
it?
Motor Show.
I was there.
Were you? Yeah, so we did.
Probably the other end of the hall.
Yeah. That was the first. That was my first ever event.
Were you inside or outside?
Inside. We had like a... There was like a group of us artists. There was a little sort of car artist sort of base. We were near...
Were you near
the stage.
Yeah, I was on the other side of that to you.
Were you?
So there was Volkswagen in between me and the stage.
Right.
And then we were near Brookspeed Porsche.
Okay.
It had that green GT car. So what would happen is people would come down the long side thing, see that Porsche, go round that, see all the artwork, see the stage, and then there was something back on my side further along.
Right.
So we were effectively in a dead spot.
Because so they sort of going round
everything that people wanted to see went round where I was. Until the Saturday, where I'd very kindly spoke to Brookspeed Porsche over the past 2 days, and they said, well, we've got enough space that we could squeeze ours in a bit and you can get your car in. So then the 86 was inside.
Right.
And then it started drawing people past me. But yeah, I must have been 50 yards away.
Yeah, not wow, okay. I don't know, we probably hadn't even spoken then, had we?
No, I don't think so.
No. No. Yeah, because that was my first event, and there was me, Ian Cook, and Juliet Marsh. We were the sort of three artists.
In the centre.
In the sort of centre bit near the stage, yeah. And Juliet,
I think I do remember seeing your stand, because you were next to Ian's.
That's right, yeah.
I think I did see that, because you had the yellow Aston Martin as
That's right, as my background bit, yeah. And that was, literally my first stand, and first time I met Ian, first time I met Juliet as well, and she was painting on a Jaguar X-Type.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. That seemed like a bizarre... I didn't really know what was going on with that.
Yeah, I think the premise was it was then being auctioned off later on in the year for a children's charity, I believe, because it was she was painting it all up like a sort of Thunderbird sort of homage thing.
Right.
Okay. All over it.
So she just poured green paint over it.
Well, it was mad. The amount of paint she put on that is just crazy, and the amount of hours she spent doing it is just nuts. Because she was, I think day one, she was doing a big Ayrton Senna portrait picture, which looked awesome, and then she was doing this the Jag afterwards. I'm not sure, I don't know if I ever sort of found out what that went to. I know it was meant to be auctioned off at some point, but I'm not sure what happened.
I think it was a young lass, Eastern European girl doing something as well.
Yes.
They had this little like go-kart looking thing.
That's right, yeah. Because she was originally there as an artist.
Oh, right.
And had then kind of changed her mind. I think she'd just graduated in engineering or something along those lines. And her and her dad and her boyfriend, I think, were this little sort of like electric go-kart kind of startup thing that they were trying to get. And I think it was something to do with that they were trying to get it into universities as like a... For student Formula One kind of that kind of thing to get people involved, young engineers involved in that kind of thing. It was what she was trying to do, but she'd used her, because she'd come as an artist, she'd decided to use her space that she'd already got to sort of promote that instead.
That was an interesting event. Are you going back this year?
I'm still undecided.
I don't think I am, because the people that run it, I've tried to talk to and get it sorted, and I'm just hitting almost walls, which is... The impression I got was that it was very much how much money can we make was the real focus.
Yeah.
And it, as much as I appreciate that that's what it's for and that's why Cinch are involved and this, that and the other, there's a certain amount of human connection that's being lost through it.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's got the Geneva Motor Show that they want it to be to justify that yet.
No, I think it's very much still growing, and I think they've got quite big ideas for it, which is good. But I think the sort of how the method of getting there maybe is not quite where it needs to be.
It doesn't fit in with my style, and because I run this business, I can treat it as I want, and I can tell people, no, thank you.
Yeah,
I don't do this full time. I don't have the pressures of that yet, so I've still got the freedom to be picky.
Picky, yeah. Well, I. Initially, when I finished the event last year, they said, do you want to come back next year? And I was like, yes, it's good. This has been a good first event for me kind of thing, to get sort of people out there and know what I do. And I still get people contacting me now that saw me there last year and stuff like that. So like long-term-wise, that really, really works. But they've changed. Some of the people who I was in contact with last year don't seem to be there anymore, and the sort of sales team that they've got seems to have changed. Much less people focused and much more like, well, this is the space you've got.
This is how much it costs.
This is how much it costs. Do you want it or not? And basically what it seems to be is that the cost of the space is the same as I had last year, but the amount of space I got is about half.
Right.
I'm like, wow.
Because it wasn't cheap.
Like, no, it wasn't a cheap event. And as my first event, it was kind of like a real sort of leap of faith for me. It's like, okay, this is going to cost me a lot of money. I need to justify this.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I said that to him because I was very fortunate in that they had a fair few empty spaces.
Yeah.
And I'd said from the get-go, I was like, I can't afford to. Thank you for your inquiry, but I can't. It was like 450 quid or something.
Yeah.
And that was for the smallest that they did. I said, yeah. I appreciate it, but no, thank you. So I was very fortunate. They said, well, because of the mental health stuff and what you represent, we can kind of give you that space for free as a last minute filler.
Yeah.
I said, that's great. Thank you very much. I'll make arrangements so that I can be there. And I think it was on like the Saturday night, something happened that I needed to go to Goodwood for the next day. It was like a young guy with cancer who's been a guest on the podcast.
Right.
It was a thing for him. And it was a really important thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, actually, I need to go to that.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm really sorry. I've got a personal thing that I need to go to. And they said, has this been your plan all along to leave a day early? I was like, right, that gives me a real indication of you as a character. If I say I've got a personal thing that I need to go to,
yeah,
and your response is an accusatory, has this been your plan? Do I really want to engage with this?
Yeah, that's not.
And then I started up the conversation this year and said, I think I'd be better placed outside as like a club with my own gazebo and a couple of cars to represent the community.
Yeah.
And I sent that to one of the top people and I got, you'll need to speak with the sales guy. So I then messaged him and said, I think this would be better suited. And he was like, do you want to buy a stand? Ignored what I said. I said, I'm not going to be funny, but had it not been for your generosity last year, I wouldn't have covered the cost of being there.
Yeah.
I don't think that suits what I'm doing. I think this would suit better. I didn't get a reply. Mm. So I'm now of the opinion, like, right, okay, stuff it.
Yeah.
I'll do it my own way and I'll do things how I want to do things. And if this isn't enjoyable, then I don't want to be doing it.
No, as simple as that. Yeah.
So I'm going to do the things that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And hopefully that will grow substantially enough for me to do that full time.
Yeah.
This isn't just a bitching contest about the bloody British Photo Show. It was a good... I met some interesting people. I made some interesting connections. Sold a few T-shirts and some hoodies and gave out a shit ton of flyers.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting the difference in the types of events that we get involved with and attend and things like that.
Yeah, I think last year, that motor show, my first one, was good because it was, in terms of it was big for little old me. I was next to Ian and Juliet, who both have done stuff before, especially obviously Ian does like 1,000 events a day.
Every single day is it something else?
Yeah, he's the busiest man ever, but also the nicest man as well. So that was the first time I ever met him. And again, because I hadn't been in the car world or whatever, was unaware of him. I have no idea how I was unaware of him, but was unaware of him. And his mum and dad were both there as well that weekend. And it was just me. I'd gone down and just booked a hotel and it was just me on my own. And they took me under their wing and treated me like another member of the family. Like,
the
Cook family were absolutely amazing to me. Like, took me out for dinner at night, met me up in the hotel and stuff like that. Like, they were absolutely fantastic. So that was, I think, and it had been my first event and got that sort of welcome. From
good start,
right? It was brilliant. I was like, wow, okay, this is this felt good. It felt good to be there, and through Ian as well, he got me my next show, which was literally a week later. He had to pull out last minute and couldn't do it.
Was that up at the Motorist?
No, that was at Carfest. So he was meant to be doing Carfest, but had basically double booked doing some event for DAF trucks or something. I think it's DAF or one of the big truck manufacturers. He'd double booked them, so then couldn't do Carfest. So it basically recommended me to them to fill his space. So I then did Carfest.
I think Carfest is really expensive.
It really can be, yeah.
Because I had a look for this year, and it was like $1,000.
Yeah.
I was like, sorry.
Yeah, it's nuts. But then Carfest for me was good. So I, again, had no idea what to do. I was literally in the middle of a field, in a lifestyle field. So I'm next to Jules selling, you know, Wellies and Bowden and all those sort of like lifestyle brands, and there's me drawing cars. It's a bit weird. But I think there was a lack of sort of car related stuff going on, as much as it's called Carfest. Off the track, there wasn't a lot of car things. So I think people then saw that I was doing car related stuff, which really helped. So, and again, I'm still getting people in contact with me now that saw me at Carfest.
So I guess from your perspective, there's kind of two sides to you being at events. There's the stuff that you can take and sell, prints and things like that. But then I imagine the real thing for you is getting those commissions come through for bespoke.
Yeah, completely. The prints there are almost like there is like the pocket money things. You know, they're relatively low cost.
Yeah.
That the kids who have got some spending money for the weekend, their festival weekend or whatever, will come and they can buy some stickers or a mug or small print for their bedroom wall and that kind of thing, which is cool. But yeah, the main thing is to get people to want to commission me, because that's obviously where, you know, how I can earn some money.
Really, isn't it?
Yeah. And yeah, it's like, I think a commission I did only as long ago as like last month originally came from Carfest, which was last August. So, you know, that's...
I've good. Technically got a bespoke page on the site. It's almost hidden.
Okay.
Because it's so time consuming.
Yeah.
And I think I've had one or two people say, I'd like a print, which is nice. It's really nice. But I've always kind of been like, oh, sure, do I push that more? And then I'm kind of like, well, actually, do I have the time to push that more?
Yeah.
So I literally got a text from someone that we were going to do a collaborative thing together. And this was 2 months ago, and I just haven't had any time to sit and do that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, now I feel really guilty. I'm like, imagine if someone was like, here's £150 to draw me something. And you're like, 2 months later.
2 months later.
I
still haven't started it yet. Yeah. And that's a thing as well, because, you know, I want to be doing this full time, and I have technically been full time on it since September. You know, so I need to make ends meet.
Yeah.
And it's about working out what you can charge somebody without it sounding silly, but also without undervaluing what you do. And I think, I don't know, I think in the creative industry, we're all pretty guilty of undervaluing what we actually do and undercharging, certainly to start with.
Yeah.
Because it sounds a lot of money when you sort of add up the hours you spend on a drawing and then charge it out an hourly rate, and you work out what that should be. You're like, well, that sounds like a hell of a lot of money. And it isn't a small purchase.
You have to be strict with yourself and go, I have to make this much an hour.
Yeah.
It has to cover that. Otherwise, you are effectively doing it for charity.
Exactly, yeah. And that's the thing. I've had a few people sort of say, well, if I you know, commission you to, say, do 3 or 4 cars, can I get a, you know, big chunky discount? And I say, well, I can give you a little bit of a discount because you're ordering a few, but it's not going to take me any less time because you've ordered 4 of them than it is if I got 4 separate customers, kind of thing.
Yeah, and I guess from your perspective, your potential to, not necessarily your potential to grow, but your limiting factor is time.
Yeah.
Like for me, because I only have to do one and then it goes out on several orders and things like that, I've got a more exponential open-endedness to it.
Yeah.
I guess for you, obviously, there will be a point where, if things grow, as I hope they do, you're going to have to start leaning a little bit more into selling prints that exist.
Yeah.
Because you're only going to be able to do one bespoke a day, and that's therefore limits you to, say, 20 a month.
Exactly, yeah.
And you've got a ceiling. So either your prices per bespoke one get more, or you have to then go, right, I need to sell more of these already drawn things.
Exactly.
So like, I bet that's a thing that you're constantly trying to juggle.
Yeah, and it's kind of what, you know, so the thing that goes into a standard print is virtually like having a commission.
Mm.
You know, they are a bit simpler because generally they're a front end drawing rather than a 3/4 view for my standard prints. Mm. And because I've done a fair few of them now, I'm getting quicker at doing them.
Yeah.
But there's still a minimum of like 8 hours of drawing that goes into a standard print. So it's like 8 hours of drawing that, or that's 8 hours towards a commission. That print, I could never sell any of them. I could put it up online and no one buys it.
Yeah.
Gets a few likes here, there or whatever, but no one actually then purchases it. But at the same token, I could spend that 8 hours doing it and then they sell loads of prints. So it's one of those sort of unknown things. Whereas those 8 hours towards a commission is finite. I know that that's towards X amount of money that commission's done. So it's easier to justify spending the 8 hours on the commission because I know that someone's already paid for that piece of time and they're going to get it out of it. So that's the sort of thing I think with the whole social media presence is that you kind of feel the pressure that I need to post regularly.
I've got to keep churning
stuff out. I need to churn stuff out because no one wants to see the same drawing over and over again. But also, I can't produce a new drawing every single day. So yeah. I haven't got brand new content to then put out. And it's kind of keeping people interested in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Enough that they actually want to see sort of behind the scenes things, or this is being printed, or this is being drawn and tweaked, and it's
of course.
That kind of pressure.
It's a real juggling act, like, all the time.
Yeah,
especially when you factor in things like social media. Like, one big challenge that I have is because I'm trying to build this brand, I have to factor in the podcast, trying to do some video stuff when I go to events.
Yeah,
creating the designs, managing. Like orders when they rarely come through, but you have this whole juggling act of right. I need all of this stuff happens where nobody sees it, and
yeah.
they see this tiny little Instagram post
and
or a Facebook post or a tweet or whatever, and it's like, oh, you are still doing something. You're like, yes, all of this stuff.
Yeah,
it takes so much time and
exactly.
energy.
You just see the little tiny bit of it.
You get this tiny little snapshot. Please like what I do so that I can continue doing it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's wild, and annoyingly, the things that are most fun make the least money.
Definitely. Yeah.
Like, they have the high potential for making connections and opportunities and things,
yeah.
but you can't just go to shows. Like, you can't just go and meet people at shows because you then run out of money very quickly.
Very, very quickly, yeah.
And it is the 12 hours designing, or it is the 8 hours editing a tiny little video, or creating social media content and stuff like that that ultimately keep things happening, but are the slow burn that you have to go through.
And that's it. It's just that keeping that constant, isn't it? And I think, you know, you run a battle against the algorithms and social media and all the rest of it, but also against your own head and your mind, because you're always going, oh, is that post going to be good enough? Does that look like this? Oh, actually, that drawing's not as good as my last one. Or does people like it?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And I think you're always in that sort of, or certainly I'll say you, me, I'm always in that sort of cycle of sort of self-doubt. And I think that sort of natural creative sort of self-doubt of going, oh, it's not good enough.
Mm.
Oh, wait a minute, I posted this.
I could tweet simpler, this and change that.
Yeah. Oh, I should have done that on it. Or I posted
morning.
Something similar last week and it got 5 likes, and someone posted it similar to that like 2 weeks beforehand and it got like 500 likes. What, you know?
Yeah.
And that's sort of always second-guessing yourself. I mean, it's funny, I recently posted a picture of Caffeine and Machine, the wall at Caffeine and Machine, because I happened to be there the day that it got finished.
Yeah.
Took a picture. There was a Renault 5 Turbo sitting there outside it. What a photo opportunity. So I literally snapped a picture on my phone, stuck it on Instagram, said, what's better, the wall or the 5 Turbo? Literally, that's all I said, didn't it? That's my most popular post.
Yeah, yeah.
By a mile. Like, compared to anything else I've ever posted.
The things that take all the time to make.
Yeah.
Like, was it when you were at I Love You Man?
Yeah, it was the I Love You Man day.
Wasn't it technically finished? I was there the next day and there was still painting on it.
Oh, were they still doing more bits to it?
Scaffolding up and doing bits on it.
Oh, okay.
Only tweaks and stuff.
Right.
Like, yeah, it was pretty much.
Yeah. And that thing's got my most popular post by a mile.
Like, my most popular post is a photo of Richard Rawlings stood in front of my Renault.
Really?
It just so happened to happen.
Was that a petrol hedonism?
Yeah, petrol hedonism. And we'd driven round to the front of Nebworth House to take photos of the car in front of it.
Yeah.
And as I was taking a photo of it, Richard Rawlings and his wife walked round the corner. And because I am not in any way like shell-shocked by celebrity or anything like that, and I don't watch Gas Monkey Garage, so I don't really care.
Yeah.
We got kind of, oh, hi, how's it going? Nice to meet you, this kind of thing. And his wife was like, this is really cute. I was like, you can have a sit in it if you want. And Richard was like, I don't think we should do that. I was like, that's fair enough. I was like, can I at least just take a photo of you in front of it to send to my mates, because it's quite a cool photo. And he was like, yeah, sure. And he'd spent the whole day being a celebrity in front of a load of people.
Yeah.
And he had no right to know who I was, or that I wasn't there in that capacity. I was there because I knew Churro, who created it, and I was milling around with him in the bar like an hour before, in the little VIP area kind of thing. I took that photo, put it up, and like nearly 2,000 likes or whatever it is on it. It's like my most engaged with post. I was like, oh. And I put the same, I had a photo of Shane Lynch from Boyzone.
Yep.
Same, sat on the Renault, this, that, and the other. And that was hilarious because I bumped into him, not near the stand. And I said, oh, if you happen to go over there, would you ask my partner just take a photo of you with the Renault? I'm trying to get as many people that I can that are interested. And he walked up to Grace and went, your other half says you need to take a photo of me in front of your car. And she was like, what? He was like, that's what he told me. And that's what I'm telling you. So I've got this photo of Shane Lynch sat on the bonnet of this Renault. And Shane Lynch is like covered in tattoos. He's got the monster cap and this and that. And like nothing.
Really?
Yeah, like very, like in comparison, hardly anything.
Hardly anything at all, yeah.
It was so strange.
Yeah.
And it's weird just what takes off and what doesn't. Like, the thing now is like TikTok and Instagram Reels and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I put a video of, it was when we were at Carnatter.
Yeah.
It was a Volvo Amazon.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
that,
yeah.
The Maguire's
one. Yeah.
Just reversing out and then driving off.
Yeah.
140,000 views on TikTok. 140,000. I put a video of the Viper ACR GTSR that was at Coffees and Cars.
Yeah.
200 views.
Wow.
The video of Henry Catchpole wearing one of my t-shirts in Carfection, 8,000, which was quite a lot.
Yeah.
But a fucking Volvo reversing out of a car park got 140,000 views.
That's nuts, isn't it?
The puppy is destroying his training pad.
He is.
Is he okay?
He's just, all he's basically saying is like, you haven't given me enough attention now. I am still here.
I just want to make sure that we don't need to go and get him out of there before.
Oh, we'll let him out so he comes and chews something different rather than his training pads. Yes, we see you.
But I wouldn't want a puppy to be choking while we're recording. He has now got paper all over his face.
Come on, you. Have some attention.
But yeah, it's just, it's absolutely mad what gets seen and what doesn't get seen and what people will like and what the algorithms will deem good enough.
Worthy,
and,
yeah.
It's absolutely mad.
And that's the game we just got to play.
Oh, it's an absolute pain in the arse. But it's a double-edged sword because you could have something that explodes and there you've got a career out of it.
Yeah.
Like, there was a company that, when I worked for UPS, they were in our area. It wasn't my customer, it was the neighbouring person's customer. And they'd make dresses.
Right.
It's a small team in Sussex. And I was chatting to them. He said, yeah, we were doing all right. And then Kim Kardashian wore one of our dresses and now we have a whole business out of it.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's all it took.
Yeah.
And it's wild how like this influencer world works.
Yeah.
And it does work, which is annoying.
Like, yes.
When Henry wore that T-shirt for the Carfection video,
yeah.
The next day my website traffic went the highest it's ever been.
Really?
Yeah.
Just from him wearing that T-shirt in a video?
Just from him wearing that T-shirt in that video.
Wow.
Not, it wasn't like he was like, here, look at this. Yeah. He's literally just wearing it and driving that car. And my website traffic like tripled.
Wow.
So I need to be like, Henry, can I just send you a T-shirt of the month? Because they have a different logo every time. And you just subtly wear
it. Yeah, just wear it every month instead.
But Carfection aren't an advertising thing. They're not a corporate. It's not their thing.
Yeah.
And it would just be a favour for a pal to try and sweet talk him into doing it. But yeah, it's mad. It's absolutely mad how that world works.
Yeah.
So what is the direction that we can expect for you for the rest, well, just going forward, basically?
Yeah, I think just more sort of variety in the work, in that I want to do some bigger pieces and more sort of sculptural or mixed media kind of pieces.
Yeah.
And get into doing more one-off bespoke things. I've had a few inquiries from some people who have got, you know, big car collections and things that want some bespoke art making for their sort of car barns and things.
Oh, amazing.
Which is really cool and really cool opportunity, and certainly something I never saw myself having, sort of thing. And it's still weird to think of myself as an artist, to be perfectly honest, because I'm just a guy who draws cars.
Yeah, yeah.
I like drawing cars and that's it. And I suppose professionally, I would never have considered myself an artist, or even, you know, I'm still on my master's, I'm an illustrator, I don't even consider myself a professional illustrator. This thing has kind of just taken off.
So you're still doing your master's then?
Yeah, I'm still doing my master's, yeah. I'm doing a master's illustration part-time, so I've got another 18 months on that.
Right.
About 18 months, I think it is, left on it. So.
Well, that must add some pressure into everything that you're doing. Because effectively doing this full-time, and you're doing your master's, and you've got a family, and a dog, and...
Yeah, it's good. I think a bit like you with the, what we were saying earlier about the sort of like last minute deadline thing. The car thing came out of me sort of seeking to ease the pressure from the studies and stuff and not concentrating on doing dissertations and work. So I'll just give myself a break and draw some cars. And it's kind of grown out of that, but it still is, I still find it therapeutic.
Yeah.
So it still is a bit of a release. So I'll carry on doing it as long as it carries on being that.
Mm.
And when it doesn't, when it no longer, you know, is that sort of therapeutic side of things. And obviously there are stresses and trying to make ends meet and money and that sort of stuff. But generally I still enjoy just getting onto my iPad and drawing for a while. And if, as and when that changes, then I will change what I do. I've always been one of these people that I've never done the same thing for very long.
Yeah.
I'm
the same. I'm about to go into a marketing job. I've never done a marketing. I built a brand and I've used that as leverage into a marketing job.
Yeah.
And it's, I changed jobs 2 years ago. I changed jobs two years before that.
Yeah. And so that's very similar to me. So 2 years is about what I sort of seem to sort of flop with. You know, I'm 39 now. And now I'm decided that I'm now an illustrator or an artist.
Yeah.
You know, these sort of thing.
In all fairness, I think Tacona is the thing I've been doing the longest. And that's only been 2.5 years.
But that's good though, because it's building and it's sort of organically building as well, because it's you and you are the brand. And that's what comes across, I think, with Tacona is you and you fully believe in it. And I think that comes across. So.
Well, I think that was the mistake I made when I started, is that I tried to position it as not that. I tried to be like, we are a brand and we are this. And the more I've engaged, the more it's actually gone to, oh, this guy's doing this thing.
Yeah.
And he believes in it.
Yeah.
And therefore that's why it exists, rather than this brand exists.
Well, I think that's, I think I'm right in saying that I got in contact with you, like slid into your DMs and all that.
when I lived in Brighton, weren't
you? Yeah. after hearing you on the Driven Chat podcast, I think.
Possibly, yeah.
Something like that. I'd heard.
Which was only at the start of this year.
Yeah. I'd literally heard that, and it's like, this guy sounds like the sort of guy I want to sort of be involved with. We have similar sort of things with mental health and stuff.
Mm.
I've suffered with depression, I think officially for probably a decade now.
Right.
And I think probably unofficially, probably double that.
Yeah.
But it's something that I've gone through various, I suppose, episodes of, but then also have been quite vocal locally and on like my own personal like Facebook page and stuff over the years of trying to sort of do my bit to promote conversation and support men's mental health. And I ran a marathon and ultra marathon for Calm a few years ago and stuff like that. To do my bit to try and spread the word and that kind of thing. And I talk to my three daughters about mental health all the time, and they know that I take medication for mental health and stuff, even though they're only young. And I'm very much
an advocate,
exactly, for sort of keeping this as an open sort of open dialect with it all, and trying to encourage, you know, anybody to actually chat about how they're actually feeling.
Yeah.
And that no way that they're feeling is the wrong way to feel. It's a genuine feeling. You're allowed to feel however you're feeling. It's just how we express that and how we deal with those things to move on. And I think becoming a dad definitely helped me deal with those feelings and sort of acknowledge that that's how I was feeling and I was allowed to feel that way. And it's just about how we deal with it.
Yeah.
And I think, listening to you on that podcast for the first time, I hadn't heard of you or knew anything about Tacona or anything before that. And I think I'd then, message you saying, I've just heard this. I've had plenty of tough times going through one now. And I just sort of wanted to say thanks that you're sort of reaching out to people and it sort of resonated. And I think, I don't know, I'm very good at sort of saying those things behind closed doors and via a DM, but not very necessarily publicly. Even though I very much encourage other people to.
Well, that's the thing. It's difficult to overcome the vulnerability of being public about things.
Yep.
Like, despite doing this and despite being the guy that's trying to get as many people to talk a bit more as I can, I still am the, like, I talk, But my initial reaction to dealing with stress is to shut down.
Withdraw, yeah.
Right, I'm going to be quiet while I try and figure out what's going on.
Yep.
I'm going to lock myself in a room and draw for a bit, or I'm going to go for a drive or a walk.
Yep.
And I'm just going to, I'll shut right the way down to try and process and figure out what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, how do I deal with this situation, and then I'll talk.
Yep.
But my initial response isn't to go, I feel like shit.
No.
It's always, right, let's shut it down
yep.
while we figure out what's happening. Because even though I do what I do, and I worked in the hospitals, and Grace is a psychologist, and I have all of these tools and resources,
yep.
it's still very difficult to identify feelings
very much so,
properly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it still takes a bit of time to go, right, I feel like this. I feel like this because of that. These emotions are what I'm going through.
Yep.
I need to not just be reacting, because my initial reacting is always aggressive. Right. Not in a, I'm going to fight someone, but it's always like, I'm sure, I'm full of adrenaline. I'm always like, right, sort of on this edge. Is shit, that's it. I've got to get this sorted, that sorted. It's never to like cry. I'm always into that fight or flight immediately.
Yep.
And it's taking that. And the reason that I shut down, I think, is because I'm aware that that's how I get.
Yeah,
so it's better for me to just be quiet.
Almost protective kind of thing.
Yeah, and then I'm not going to cause damage.
Yep.
I'm not going to upset anyone by being short and snappy. I'll be quiet while I figure it out, and then I can approach you when I have grown up a little bit and gone, right, this is what I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And if that's the case for me, despite everything that I've done and I do and I know and everyone that I've got around me,
yeah,
for blokes that haven't got any sort of, like, tools to deal with things, or are in an environment where it's not okay to seem weak or to share vulnerability, it must be absolute hell.
Yeah.
And to have more conversations happening and to be more public about, no, it's okay. Like, you don't have to be big, strong bloke
who
takes everything on the chin and keeps going. It's all right to go, I need some time, or I'm feeling vulnerable, or I'm feeling like crap, or that's actually affecting me.
Yeah.
And it takes some real strength, if anything, to do that.
Yeah. I think we're so good at blocking it out.
Yeah.
So the first part is recognising it yourself. And that's almost difficult, because I know, you know, I'm quite inexperienced with my own mental health and stuff. And I have, like you said, you know, I've got a lot of tools and a toolkit to work out what's going on. And I know the things I should and shouldn't be doing. And I know what's good for me and what isn't good for me. But I still find myself leaning on things like alcohol. You know, I'm feeling rubbish, oh, I'll have a beer.
Yeah.
That'll make me feel better at the end of the day and stuff like that, knowing full well that actually it achieves the opposite.
It's a depressive.
It's a depressive. But I'll still use that as a crutch to lean on, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Even though I know full well it isn't. And then, you know, then that's not helping.
And then you feel guilty.
Then you feel guilty about it. And then it's just a cycle about, well, actually, I'm feeling this way because I haven't helped myself and I've been doing all these things. And it's kind of, sometimes you just need someone else to sort of say, no, stop, you're beating yourself up over this.
Yeah,
you're doing your absolute best. Yes, that wasn't the best decision, but it also wasn't the worst decision. You can carry on from this and let's just take a step back and sort of do these things. And I think sometimes it's more difficult, not more difficult, it's as difficult for our partners and loved ones to see us going through these things, that don't necessarily know how to deal with it. Or haven't had it to deal with it directly themselves. They're just dealing from a partner's point of view and stuff. And I feel sorry for my other half quite a lot that has to put up with me and going through these things, because I can't always articulate what's actually going on in my head.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's always there to pick up the pieces and kind of help me through these things.
Yeah, well, we're both very lucky to have other halves that are in the position and that do that.
Yeah. Like,
it would be very easy and somewhat justified if someone's go, I'm also dealing with shit.
Yeah.
You need to deal with your shit while I deal with my shit.
Exactly, yeah. It's like, wait a minute, you're not the only one with shit going on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it, again, adds to, not everybody has that.
No.
And there are a lot of services out there that exist, especially if you need to talk to someone, or if you need to just go, I feel like this, I need to just not have this bottled inside me.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people that need those things that don't feel like they can engage with those things.
And I think that's the whole... So I originally said I did some work for Calm. Mm. I came across Calm because I used one of their services. I used their like call line thing. And then I I've phoned their line a few times, and when I've been sort of, you know, on the edge and things, and they, you know, they've talked me through things and been really, really good.
Yeah.
Which is why I then, you know, wanted to raise some money for them and sort of,
well, that's
sort
what of pay I do back and stuff. 10% of profits to Calm.
To Calm.
I
as
think
well.
They're a really good one.
Yeah.
And I think they're going about it the right way in terms of, like, they work with like Dave, the channel and stuff.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
They're making it more normal part of culture.
Very much so.
Which I wholeheartedly agree with, which is why I do the things that I do in the way that I do them, is
yeah.
to make it more normal part of life
yeah.
rather than, oh, look how great this is. Like, no, it's just, it's part of life, mate.
Yeah, this is it, exactly. This is part of everyday kind of thing. This
yeah.
is, people are going through this all the time. This is not anything special. This is very
it's
much
normal.
Normal. Yeah. And yeah, I think the Calm people that, I think from my point of view, they just came across as just, they genuinely cared.
Mm.
Like, they didn't know who I was on the end of the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know who they were on the other end of the phone. But they genuinely gave a shit that I was still there and still alive and still talking and stuff. And when I got the chance to go down to Calm head office and meet them all and everything before I did my fundraising stuff for them, they're like genuinely the loveliest people, just
yeah.
like really passionate about what they do and actually care. And yes, they've got quite a few sort of like celebrity endorsements and things going on, but they weren't ahead of themselves at all. They were just very much, we are normal people that care.
Mm.
And they'd all had their own sort of, you know, reasons of wanting to be involved in things, and even down to, like, I can't think of the guy's name, the guy who runs it, the sort of chairman of it, he's had his own sort of, you know, issues with depression and things. They were sort of leading by example and his own experiences, and I think that just
yeah.
comes across with people like that. And I know there's now a lot more mental health charities out there, and it is becoming more talked about, or people are saying it's good to talk and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is really, really good, and normalising it. But I think sometimes the whole, oh, it's good to talk, and that can sometimes belittle what people are going through as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It sometimes can devalue it, and you go, oh, I suffer with depression. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm a bit depressed today too. And it's like, well, actually,
no, we all have bed. You're
yeah.
just feeling like there's
yeah.
different levels.
Ups and downs, and people can be low, and feeling depressed on one day is absolutely normal, and having highs and lows throughout your life and throughout your day and is absolutely perfectly normal part of life. And yet having depression is obviously a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, there's almost that sort of danger of, we're talking more about depression in a word, but are we...
Similar with anxiety. There's a difference between feeling anxious and having anxiety.
Exactly, yeah. Like, we all feel anxious about things. That's perfectly normal.
Yeah.
Like, that's an everyday sort of, you know, regular emotion that we should be feeling towards things. That's perfectly logical.
Yeah.
But actually having anxiety
is a debilitating thing. Like,
and there isn't rationale behind it. That's the whole point of it. It isn't, because if it was rational, you could talk yourself out of it.
Yeah.
And I often think that about depression. It's like, why are you feeling low? It's like, well, if I knew that, and it was logical I'm feeling low about these
things,
I wouldn't be feeling like it, or I could find an easy way of talking myself back out of it. And I think, yeah, that's kind of one of the issues, is that we are talking more about depression, but I'm not sure necessarily there's that much more understanding of it.
Yeah. It's almost being watered down to a certain
yeah,
extent.
And it's brilliant that more people are talking about it, and I think it's far more acceptable for people to have conversations about it, which is a brilliant, brilliant thing. I just think, yeah, we need to be careful that we're not diluting it and actually still treating it as, you know, the sort of
actual medical thing
that it is,
yeah,
rather
yeah.
than just sort of belittling it and going, oh, I'm feeling a bit rubbish today. Did that resonate with you? Did you like that, Arlo?
Yeah.
It suddenly popped up.
For the last 20 minutes, the dog has been attacking Terry's hand.
Yeah, I haven't got
he's
much
got a,
hand left.
He's got a toy that Terry's trying to get him to chew on, and every time he gives it to him, he lets go and just bites
just
him on the hand.
Just my hand, yes.
And then all of a sudden, he stopped, his ears perked up, and he realised that I existed again. Yeah, if you can hear chomping, it's Terry's
yeah, sorry,
dog
yeah,
being
apologies.
Chewed to death
it's,
by
it's
a
not
puppy.
Me just chewing on things, it is the dog.
But yeah, I think it is something that it's great that people acknowledge the existence of.
Yep.
But there's also we need to be careful not to devalue the more extreme end of it.
Yep.
And the actual diagnosed depression.
Yes.
There's feeling depressed is probably the reason that that's happening, is that statement.
Yep.
Not, oh, I'm feeling low, or I'm feeling run down.
And
it's that
it.
I'm feeling depressed. It's like...
Yeah.
I get what you mean. That's
yeah.
not really what you're feeling
yeah.
in the technical term.
Yeah.
You're feeling low. Or you've
yeah.
got low energy, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're sort of, you know, burnt out and that kind of stuff, yeah, which is all part of
a bit different to clinical depression,
yeah,
which is a lot more severe. And having worked in the environments with a lot of these in their most severe forms, you kind of go, all right, have you tried running into a wall today? No, maybe calm it down a little bit. Like someone who's really depressed and wants that pain to stop will do those things.
Yeah.
Whereas someone that's feeling depressed will have a low day and it's justified and it's normal.
Yep.
But tomorrow you'll probably be a little bit better. Or you'll have a cup of coffee and it'll help a little bit. Or you'll go for a walk and it'll...
And suddenly...
Because there's always that, like, oh, have you tried going outside? It's like... Yeah. Shut the fuck up. Yeah. That's not the cure for depression. Yeah. That's the helps you when you're feeling low.
A bit low.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're all good things. You know, exercise helps me massively, which is why I ended up running marathon and things like that.
Yeah.
It's like, because
I can't
that,
run to save my life.
That became a thing for me. And I couldn't, honestly. Ask any of my schoolmates and something, like the idea of me doing athletics or anything sporty, you know, it was just not a thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, then it suddenly was a thing. I think the BBC did a documentary called Mind Over Marathon.
Right.
I can't remember how many years
ago
it was. The ultimate
version of Couch to 5K.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was basically that. It was, and Calm were part of it. And it was like, let's take six ordinary people who suffer with depression. We all know that exercise is meant to be good for us, but let's document it, them, their sort of struggles. And I think it started off with maybe 8 or 10 people, and only 6 got through to actually doing the London Marathon out of it. But that kind of made me think, well, actually,
yeah,
let's give it a go.
Mm.
And I went out, and I know it sounds one of these things, like, it changed my life. But I went out the next morning and attempted to run 5K.
Which is harder than you think if you don't run.
I think I ran about 500 metres of the 5K and walked the rest because I just couldn't. Like, I had no fitness or anything like that.
3K recently. And I was like, okie dokie.
Yeah.
But I did the loop. I finished the loop without stopping. And that was my real achievement.
That was your achievement, getting to that bit. And I think it'd be on my Strava and that somewhere. Is that, so my first 5K that morning, the first ever 5K I'd done, took me like an hour to do a 5K. And I was like, oh, yeah, doing this for several hours, getting around a marathon, that's going to be damn difficult.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if I don't sign up to it, I won't do it. I'll talk myself out. So I literally applied that day to Calm to get a marathon place and managed to get one. So I was like, I've got to do it now. And I think it was about 12 months, I think, before the actual marathon. So I was like, right, I've got a year to go from can't run anywhere to be able to get around
26.
A marathon.
Jeez. Yeah.
And yeah, that sort of just having that focus and training. And I'd just gone through kind of stereotypical midlife crisis. I'd had like a meltdown in my sort of work life and had to sort of leave that for, you know, for health reasons and stuff. And I was like, right, this is going to be my positive focus to go on. And yeah, and then had my 3 daughters at the finish line of Brighton Marathon to see me across it. And that is six years ago now.
Right.
But that still sticks in my head like it was yesterday. That sort of moment.
That's amazing.
Was brilliant.
But it really kind of pulled you into the accountability if you've got to get it done,
and that helped. The accountability. That was a completely it. I wasn't accountable to myself because I can just fob myself off easily. It was that I've now told people publicly that I'm doing it, and people have paid money, people have sponsored me. This is a responsibility. I can't now just go, oh, I really can't be bothered. I can't do this. Oh, I can't get out of bed today to go and do this training run. I need to just do something else instead.
Mm.
It was like, well, these people have put their faith in me and money, like hard-earned money, into sponsoring me. I've got to do this.
Yeah.
And that made a huge, huge difference.
Yeah, yeah. Like I used to do jiu-jitsu and bits of mixed martial arts. I'd never done that before. And when I moved to Brighton, I was like, I need to make some friends.
Right, yeah.
And I've always kind of liked the idea. And I'd heard it's good for, like, you connect with people and it's good for discipline and it's good for fitness. I was like, might as well go and give it a go.
Yeah.
And I really, really fell into doing that. Oh, phone's gone, glasses gone, everything's gone, puppy life.
Yeah.
But again, that was a thing where it was like, I didn't really know what to expect. And I got into it, and then I really got into it, and then I made friends out of it. And then when that stopped for about 6 months, I had so much like pent up, not like aggression, but like I didn't have that release anymore.
Yeah.
And I really struggled with it. And we were chatting, Grace and I were chatting the other day, because I nearly got in a fight in traffic by this absolute like roid head that had dived out in front of the car, then tried to brake check me a few times, and then thrown Pepsi out the window over the back of the car. I was in Grace's car, I wasn't in the Toyota, otherwise I'd have probably got out. And we got to this set of lights. Like, I managed to get past him, which he tried to swerve into me when I did.
Jesus Christ.
Got to this set of lights, and he got out, came screaming over at the window, like he was going to try and punch me while I was sat in the car. And I just kept putting my arm up in the window so he couldn't.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Grace. She went, "You've not had anything like that for a while." And she's like, "Good on you for not getting out of the car, first of all, because you are Mr. There's a confrontation. I need to sort it out."
Yeah.
And she's like, "How did you keep yourself calm?" I was like, "I don't know." She's like, "Because I remember you saying when you'd stopped training, because I was doing 4 hours a day."
Wow. Okay.
Like, so I really fell into it. Like, I was like, "I'll just do this class, and I'll just do this one, and I'll just do this." And then it was like, "Right, 4 hours." She said, "Like, I remember when you said after you had to stop because of the lockdown, and when we moved away from Brighton." She's like, "You were tense all the time."
Yeah.
"And you were ready for a fight all
just
the time.
Just on edge kind of thing.
Just like ready to get all of that testosterone that you would like using to do that in a positive way, then had nowhere to go." And she was like, "You were just tense constantly." And that really contributed to like a really low period that I was going through, because I was feeling tense all the time, had no healthy release for it. And other difficulties were happening. And it's surprising how much it helps just to be able to go for an hour and lift heavy things or run or like whatever it is that you do.
Yeah.
And to have something that forces you to do that is really helpful. Like currently I'm not registered to any gyms or anything.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, if I pay money, I probably will go.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it kind of forces you to
do it because I've spent this money now. I need to justify that cost. Yeah.
And money's not easy to come by at the minute.
No.
So it's a real kind of, you have to invest in yourself kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm the same with running now. Like, I know I'll feel much better, you know, for doing running. I haven't run for ages. Like, through lockdown, I was still running and stuff, but then I tweaked my ankle, so then stopped running for a while, and then just kind of haven't been back since. And it's kind of, there's no accountability. It's only me. So it's easy for me not to go for a run.
Yeah, like, I am an avid, like, don't have your phone in bed, read and get up with an alarm clock. And I regularly struggle to do that.
Yeah.
I'm very much a practice, do as I say.
As I do.
Yeah, because I've got no accountability. Exactly. And then Grace would be like, "Oh, I thought you were going to leave your phone." I'm like, "Yeah, it'd be all right." She's like, "No, put your phone down." I'm like, "Yeah, it'd be okay." And I'm like, "I just need to go to the toilet," and then I'll sit down for half an hour.
Exactly, on your phone, yeah.
And it's tough, and it's really tough.
Yeah.
And it is that self-discipline.
Yeah, and it's constant as well, because as soon as you let yourself off for that one thing, that then becomes an excuse, and it's just, I didn't do it because of that, and no, actually, I'm not now going to do it because of that.
Yeah.
Stop on my watch strap, you.
And it is okay, and that's the thing. Like,
yeah.
You can't, like, all these people that look at all these millionaires that I go up at four every day, and I go to the gym.
Yeah.
And then I go to work, and this, and they're like, "Oh, that's what I have to do."
Yeah.
And then they try it for a week, and like, "Oh my god, this is so hard." And then they feel guilty for not doing it.
Yeah,
that's okay. You don't have to live that lifestyle.
No.
And if The Rock is getting up at four, it's because he's earning £10 million to be The Rock.
To be that, exactly.
And he has to look like that, so he therefore has the intrinsic motivator that he needs to have that lifestyle. Otherwise, he doesn't get the millions and millions of pounds that he's earned.
Exactly. So that's quite an easy sort of thing to go, well, this is why
he's
doing
it. That's
his job.
That's his job. Get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go and lift heavy things for an hour.
Which,
and to eat 8 million calories.
Which, you know, we don't get paid to do.
No.
Or even remotely that sort of thing.
I get paid if someone buys a t-shirt. That's the only thing that...
Exactly. And I get paid if someone buys a bit of my artwork or wants me to draw some of their artwork and things. And it's that. But also, you only get the snapshot social media version of that life. There's definitely days where The Rock doesn't want to get up and at 4 a.m. eat his millions of calories and all the rest of it. And
no, I imagine there's like days where he doesn't want to speak to another person on the planet because he's the most popular man in the universe.
Exactly.
I imagine he'll have days where he's like, "I just want to shut everything down, in bed and eat a load of crap.
I just want to be a normal person for a change rather than being The Rock or a celebrity or this, that and the other."
I was we were at the Scramble on Sunday and I bumped into Harry Metcalf.
Yep.
And I knew where his car was. I was like, "I'll go over there so I can just say, how is the best way to get in touch with you?"
Yeah.
For like podcast guests, something like that.
Yeah.
And as I was approaching, he was about to leave. I was like, right, I'll just quickly go, how can I send you a message?
Yeah.
Like, what's going to get seen?
Seen by you.
Or replied to. As I was walking over, this couple walked over. Oh, my God, Harry. Oh, we watch all of your shows. We watch every episode. Can we have a selfie? I was like, the poor guy just wants to come and look. He was stood chatting to someone with an Alfa, looking at their engine.
Yeah.
He's like, the poor guy just wants to enjoy cars.
Yeah.
Give him 5 minutes
break. Let him just
So then I
chill,
had to follow up this couple that had just hounded him going, Harry, how do I contact you professionally from an actual perspective, not just because I like what you do?
Yeah.
Like, I just said, I run a an automotive podcast. How do I get in touch properly? And he was like, send me a message on whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's poor guy. He's like, he's not a young guy.
No, he's not.
And he's now, because he's done some stuff on YouTube and he is who he is, he's now getting hounded by strangers in a car park for photos with him. And bless him, he was very kind.
Yeah.
And those people are effectively how he's paying his bills.
Exactly, yeah.
He needs viewers, so it comes part and parcel. But it there must be days where he's like, I don't want this.
Yeah. Just let me be a person rather than Harry Metcalf personality.
And that's probably why the Tire Kicker Club exists, because they are, it's not a public thing.
Yeah.
It's a certain group of people that are well known, and they all go out, and you only find out that they've been anywhere is when they post about it.
Exactly, and it's in retrospect, it's already happened. You can't then suddenly
so you
appear
can't
at
get
these
mobbed
things
or anything like that. And I think it's something I'm very conscious of as I get a little bit more well known.
Yeah,
and because a lot of what I do is personality driven, and I'm more and more in the public eye as it grows. Can you stop chewing on my shorts, please, mate? I'm going to look like I've wet myself. It's something I'm very conscious to be aware of, the pitfalls of that. You can't chew this watch. This was a birthday present. And it is an interesting world to be in some way involved in, and an interesting thing to have some exposure to.
Yeah.
And the more that we get involved in the car world and the more well-known we are, the more likely it is that we're going to encounter these situations. And it's an interesting dynamic to have engagement with. Fortunately, we're known for doing nice things, so we're not getting hounded.
No, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really interesting world to be getting more behind the curtain of.
Yeah.
And becoming more connected in.
Well, I think, and especially with you, you know, yes, Tacona isn't your name, but you are Tacona.
Yeah.
And we're always saying, like, you are the brand, and you very much represent the brand, and you are it. So you are, you know, Tacona guy, like you know, your Twitter handle, etc. You are that guy, and you are the face of it, but you are it. And yes, I am illustrator maker, but I am just that guy that draws cars or whatever. And it's kind of, people know you for that's what you do.
Yeah.
And you're not part of a big team. It's not like, oh, like brand Tacona is a squad of 50 people
sitting
there working behind the scenes, and you're all out in t-shirts and stuff. It is you.
Yeah.
So if at any stage you get any negativity,
it's
they're saying towards you. And the same for me.
I had that recently. I put a photo up of a Rolls Royce in Essex, bright red, and it said Fatso on the number plate. And it's a well-known car. It was a guy off The Apprentice or this,
that. Right, okay.
And I said, there's a lot to take in here. Just not saying anything
negative
directly, just
like,
saying,
wow,
there's a lot to take in here.
Rolls Royce with that number plate on it and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Someone gave me some real shit on the comments. Like,
really
gave me some shit. And then they're like, I can't believe Henry Catchpole is associated with this brand, trying to criticise someone, blah, 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 blah. And I replied saying, you know, I'm just a guy, right? It's all just me. I'm one person doing all of this. I'm just a guy.
Yeah.
There's bigger things to worry about than me calling a flash car a flash car.
Yeah.
And the guy didn't reply. I was like, I think that technically means I win this argument.
Wow.
But what a dick move to go,
yeah,
you can't say that a bright red Rolls Royce with fats on the number plate outside
is a little bit flash.
Yeah, it's a flash car.
Yeah.
I can't. And then trying to bring in people that are connected, like known for, and tarnished reputations and stuff.
Wow.
I was like, you absolute dick. I hope I never meet you in person.
Yeah,
because I'm a lot more intimidating if you piss me off in real life.
It's just like, why people feel they've got the right to do stuff like that. And I get, you know, it's, we put stuff out there publicly, and that's, you know, and the keyboard warrior sort of thing. People feel they can, if you've put something out publicly, then they can, you know, comment back or whatever. But just, if that's how you feel about it, surely just pop a message into your DM and say, look, I don't think you meant this necessarily, but this is how it came across in this sort of negative way. And then you could clarify your position without any of that being public and needing to be sort of a sort of then become a sort of slanging match, which didn't need to happen in the first place.
Yeah, but you still run the risk of they'll just screenshot the DMs and post that anyway.
Yeah, true.
And then you're like, well, it's public either way, isn't it?
Yeah.
But no, it's wild, and it's an interesting world that we live in.
Yeah.
But we've hit an hour and a half now.
Oh dear.
And we've definitely gone off on some really
very
interesting
weird tangents.
We very much strayed away from the fact that you're Terry that draws cards, which is quite nice.
Yeah, sorry to anybody that actually listens to this. It's not.
They're like, I wanted to know how to draw.
Or any sort of cohesive podcast. It's like, well, it's just two blokes rambling on about random things now.
Yeah, which is half the fun of it. But where can people find you?
So I am illustrator_maker on Instagram. Annoyingly on Twitter, I am illustratormake, because it was one letter too short to have Illustrator Maker, which is really annoying. And on Facebook, I think it's just Illustrator Maker you find. But if you Google Illustrator Maker, you will find me across sort of social media and stuff. But yeah, perfect. There is illustratormaker.co.uk as well.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sitting and going on all these tangents with me, Terry.
No, thank you.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate that we've touched on quite a lot of mental health stuff as well, which is nice. It helps to reinforce what we're doing.
Yeah, I think and from my point of view, it's not like a therapy session, but it's good for me to continue to be positive and quite happy to talk about stuff like that. And I'm always more than happy to sort of lend an ear if that helps people as well.
Be mindful that if that happens and this becomes very popular, you might be the next calm chat line. So, and that's one thing that I've been very conscious of is directing people to the right resources.
Yes.
Because I am one bloke.
Yes.
And because of the imagery that I've built around Tacona, it might not necessarily seem like that immediately.
Yeah.
So I'm very conscious of use the proper functions, because I'm not the person that's qualified to do this.
Yeah.
I can give you a bit of help, but I'm not going to give you the proper help. You might as well go direct to the people
who can
do it properly and do a good job of it. So yeah, be mindful.
Yes.
If this gets heard by 100 people and 10 of them go, oh, chat up to Terry, and you're like, oh crap. I would always recommend going to the proper people, because they are there for more than just suicide prevention.
Very much so.
Which I think is also something that needs a lot more awareness around, is these services exist for normal conversation when things need a bit more reassurance.
Yeah,
it's
way
not
before
just a
you
last
just
resort.
Get to the last minute, exactly. Yeah, definitely.
They exist as a last resort, but they are more than that,
definitely.
And they should be used as such, because they'd much rather help you on a down day that prevents things getting worse than they would want to have to try and talk you down from that last situation.
Very much so, yeah.
I think that's really worth a lot more clarification, that if I were in there, choose, I'd rather go, yes, okay, we can help you get through a down day, then, oh no, please.
Exactly.
So,
do we need to get an ambulance involved or anything like that? You don't want it to be anywhere near that extreme.
Exactly. We can be preventative in that case.
Yeah.
But again, thank you so much for sitting and chatting. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to hit the stop record button now.